Backseat Producers, episode 216, Rumblefish. This is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Jill.
And we are the Backseat Producers. We didn't decide what we're talking about next week. We know what range we're with. Let's do following.
Sounds good.
Following next week.
Following.
All right, so this is the first week of our modern black and white films series. We're talking about Rumblefish. High-level thoughts?
I kind of like this movie. For all sorts of different reasons. We'll get into some of the things I didn't like about it, but overall I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I love it. It's one of my favorite Coppola movies.
I got about an hour into this movie, and I was kind of lost. I didn't know what to expect. But by the end, I really liked the whole presentation. I wanted to go back and watch it again, and I probably will at some point, but I want to kind of sit on it for a little while before I go back to really digest it. So,
but I think that's what I like about it. There's so much, particularly visually, to this movie. It's so complex that you can go back and find things that you didn't notice before.
The aha moment.
I think my problem that's totally me, and it was the expectations that I came into it with, was I was thinking Coppola, Hinton, Dylan, Outsiders.
Yeah,
that's my experience, and that's what I'm coming in expecting. I'm expecting something like The Outsiders, especially with a title like Rumblefish. I'm thinking and seeing some of the imagery where he looks kind of like a 50s thug. Yep. You know, it's like this is going to be kind of like The Outsiders. Okay, that's what I'm coming in ready to expect. And
nope.
10 minutes in, it's like, this is not The Outsiders. Not at all.
Well, and Coppola refers to it as his carrot for finishing The Outsiders, which I think is interesting also.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, can you read into it? Is this the movie he really wanted to do? And Outsiders was just a way to kind of carry it over?
Well, they say,
or is this the opportunity for him to just experiment and go wild?
Well, said in the notes that he wrote this screenplay on the Sundays they had off while he was doing The Outsiders.
Yeah. And well, they filmed it in the same place, used a lot of the same...
Same cast and crew. In fact, he did it right after he finished The Outsiders.
Yeah.
But it is a totally different movie.
Oh, very much so.
You know, I thought about going back and watching The Outsiders again just for the contrast, but instead what I did was go back and look at things like West Side Story. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched that because there are elements in this movie that reminded me of that. I thought about going back and looking at like a couple of Truffaut films, and but then I was like, no, that's way over the top and a little bit too intense. Because of the avant-garde nature of some of the shots and decisions that he made.
Yeah.
The camera work in this thing was pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
Considering the limited resources they had.
Well, and that's the neat thing too is, and I didn't realize, I was telling Tony earlier, I saw this movie when it was in the theaters. My dad took me to see it. And there are shots in it that I vividly remember. And one of them is the clouds crossing in the pet shop window is one of the images that is kind of burned into my head from that movie. But now going back and in reading about it too, which we really didn't have a lot of access to when this movie came out, learning about all of the experimental techniques that he worked with, like the color for the fish was a totally new film technique.
Yeah.
The music was a totally new way of developing musical score.
Yeah, considering all, considering who scored it was Stuart Copeland, who was the drummer for The Police.
Yeah.
And the guy who did was the front man for Wall of Voodoo.
Well, and that's just it. When I was listening to the music, I could hear riffs in the score that's like, I can't place which song it is, but like I heard four or five different Police songs as I'm listening to the score, and it's like, those are riffs from Police songs. He's lifting stuff,
right, but
and that's
done
great.
With industrial instruments.
It's great.
It wasn't even all pure musical instruments.
No, it was cool. Really cool. And one of the things that really struck me, at first I thought I had a problem with my audio, because there were sections of the movie where it seems like the audio is reversed, where the dialogue is played almost as the score, and the score is played as dialogue, where the score is that much louder than the dialogue, so
apparently
you can barely hear it.
It annoyed the sound folks. Did you read that?
No.
They named it Mumblefish, was their nickname for the movie, because they had issues with the score and with Mickey Rourke.
I can see that, because Mickey Rourke... All right, so... Let's go back to form here for a minute. Acting. I think Mickey Rourke was amazing.
Oh, and I thought he was amazing. I love the whole cast.
Yeah,
the
cast is fantastic.
I like Tom Waits for this quirky, weird character that he had, and the kind of the mumbling he did in the background, and you'll hear him in some of the scenes when he's off. Mm-hmm. I loved him. Harry Dean Stanton. No. Dennis Hopper was amazing
as their dad. Yeah,
the scene with him and the two boys in the bar is my favorite. Entire movie.
That was awesome. That
the
was
way it's
really
filmed,
good.
The content, and just how beautiful his face is in terms of character and emotion, and the way his face is filmed, but also the way the picture is framed is. Just one of the best shots I've ever seen in terms of particularly for a character actor like him. But just, I mean, quirky, massive, just young actors. And, we talked about Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah.
It's like, where did he come from?
Yeah, and he looks like an infant.
Yeah.
He almost doesn't even look like himself.
It was about his third major motion picture when he was in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, at first it was like, I know that's not Samuel L. Jackson. No, that's Lawrence Fishburne.
Before
holy cow.
He went through puberty.
Yeah.
He was so thin.
Yeah, because he was tiny.
Yeah.
Did you know, I noticed this when I was looking, and I mean to go back. The next time I watched it, I'm going to watch for it again. Essie Hinton's actually in the movie.
Yeah, she's the prostitute.
Yeah,
at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's not a great actress, so it was good then.
Yeah.
But it was a plot driver too, because she's the one that lures Steve away, and so then it becomes the conversation with Rusty James and Motorcycle Boy.
Yeah.
But we were talking before you got here that one of the things that struck me was a couple of things with the acting. One, you talked about how Mickey Rourke reminded you of
like a Brando.
Brando.
Almost like a Brando, because he was so
withdrawn,
distracted. Yeah, it was more distracted.
Well, and the quality of the way he delivered the lines too kind of reminds me, particularly like on the waterfront Brando.
Yeah.
Where
it's like he's doing a job and he's playing this character, but he's almost not there in some ways, and it. And one of the things I read after the fact was that he said that he approached the character as if he was an actor who didn't care about acting anymore. And it was like after hearing that, it's like, yeah, that works.
Well, you
but
could also say he's a gangster who just don't want to be a gangster anymore. And he's outlived the reputation and just realizes how stupid it all is.
Yeah, it's a really he's. For what could be a very simple two-dimensional character, he's so layered with his physical dysfunctions and the fact that he doesn't even have a name.
Mm-hmm.
He's
well,
the motorcycle boy.
He doesn't even
boy.
Have an adult male name. He's the boy.
The boy, yeah.
You know, and something.
And he's 21.
He's really old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he looks like he's 25.
Yeah.
He about died on that one.
Yeah.
But there's things about him that are childlike and boyish, like like the cut of his hair, you know, and the fact that he's kind of unkempt. The level of play, like when he steals his father's whiskey bottle and that kind of childhood laughter and kind of hugging on the mattress on the floor where Rusty James is like completely up. He doesn't have that bond with his father at all. So,
right.
So there are some definite things that were nice little layers to it. And one of the things that struck me is, and what I liked about his character in particular was this idea, and the dad uses the line that he has the ability to do anything he wants to do, but finds nothing he wants to do.
Right.
And so when you talk about an actor who doesn't really care, that's it.
It's perfect.
It's dead on.
Because yeah, he's a character. And he's a child who suddenly is in the adult world, and he suddenly realizes that, hey, where am I? What am I to do now? I've lost my previous role. What am I to do now?
Well, and the movie's kind of, I mean, this is, might be a stretch, but in my mind, it's from his vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
Rusty James is the main character, but it's motorcycle.
The story is not his.
Well,
yeah.
it's motorcycle's viewpoint. That's why it's in
that's
black
why it's in black and white.
And that's why also the sound fades in and out at points. And when it gets really chaotic, the background noise overwhelms the dialogue. Just like if you were deaf, that background noise would overwhelm. You wouldn't be able to hear the subtle things. And I thought it was interesting because then you can kind of carry that over to the whole idea of loss of childhood and loss of freedom, and how he talks about remembering when he could see color.
Yeah.
I remember I could see color. And then he talks about how, but I haven't been, I lost, stopped being a kid at 5. You know, and so is that kind of a juxtaposition that when, you know, you lose your childhood, you lose the ability to see color because you're trapped in this purgatory of young adulthood.
Yeah. So one of the things that struck me about the score, and when the score would rise up and the dialogue would kind of fall, it always seemed to happen in points when the dialogue really didn't matter, when people were talking just to make noise, when they were just because it first happens when the guys are all just walking and big talking and bullshitting and hey, yeah, we're gonna go do this, and it's just they're pretty much just saying the same things over and over again, and it's the point when even when you're out talking with your friends, you kind of sometimes let your mind wander because you know, even in this conversation, you're actively taking part in that nothing's really being said. So your mind's wandering, you're looking around, if you're at a bar, you're people watching, you're involved in a conversation because you're speaking, but you're also kind of not there. Yeah, you're just not there present in this conversation. And it seemed, the music seemed to kind of bring that out and kind of show you that, you know, yeah, you're part of the scene, but this isn't really what's important. You know, hearing what they're saying isn't what you should be focused on right now. Pay attention to what's on the screen. Listen to what's going on. And I thought that was really neat. The other thing that struck me about Motorcycle Boy and the way he talked is, and I've heard this power theory, you know, you're talking about people who are in control of situations and do that. And it's what he did was he talked very slowly, very softly. It forced everyone around him to stop and listen because what he said was important, or it made it seem more important just because they had to stop and listen to him because he was so soft-spoken. But it wasn't like he was meek.
A true leader really doesn't have to shout.
And that was kind of the way he played it, and I dug that. I liked how that worked out.
But he really, the interesting thing though is particularly like the name Motorcycle Boy. There's nothing really descriptive, and then the fact that they compared him to the Pied Piper and Robin Hood, who again. Yeah, they weren't known for their true identity. It was kind of
their myth.
Exactly.
Yeah, the myth that he's tried to live up to.
Yeah. That, and so, you know, him coming back, I thought that was interesting because, you know, even his own brother built him up and didn't see him for who he really was.
What struck me as funny, and I kind of thought about this after the fact too, with how he spoke, it almost made me wonder, because I've never read the book, and I don't know if there's any more to it than that, but was Motorcycle Boy, was he really this badass character, or was he always just this soft-spoken guy who was a little bit off, and because he was soft-spoken, people paid more attention to him, and that kind of put him in a position of being somebody that everybody listened to and everybody followed. And then when he went away, or was it because he was off? I mean,
he makes reference to that too.
Which of those things, because it could be any of those things, that's the reason that he, that people look at him.
He had a natural charisma, apparently, because he was able to get all the gangs to stop fighting.
Right.
Because he realized, he says it to Rusty while they're all beat up under the bridge. He said, "We all realize it wasn't any fun. It was just ridiculous."
Yeah.
But all the younger ones are still caught up in this mythology of, oh, we got to fight, we got to get hurt, we got to have fun this way. But he's trying to tell them that life is over.
And Rusty James seems to be, at least at the beginning, he seems to be trying to come out from under his brother's shadow. And that's why he's, you know, he gets the rumble going. He wants, you know, his buddies
really
are like, hey,
care about it. Yeah, he doesn't care about anything.
No, because he doesn't even show up to the last second.
Well, but even that, I mean, he goes to hook up with his girl he supposedly loves, but even that, he has this other thing planned. So
right.
There's nothing in his life that really has any meaning. School doesn't have meaning.
His girlfriend doesn't have meaning. I mean,
no,
his gangmates, you know, they don't really have any meaning either. I mean,
you know, and the only thing
they're all just trappings.
Is he doesn't want to be alone.
No.
Yeah, but yeah, right. He really also desperately wants to connect with his father. I mean, I thought Matt Dillon did a really good job of showing pain mm-hmm. without looking weak, and showing that angst without going over the top. You know, he reminded me, and I think a lot of it's the way he delivered his lines, a lot of like a James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, that kind of unusual slow pacing. At times it kind of seemed contrived the way he delivered his lines, but yet it worked. So you're kind of like going, all right, was that on purpose or is he just a bad actor?
Yeah.
But it really was part of the kind of the character.
Or is he a conflicted character?
Yeah, and that was a good part of it.
All right, so without having done any research, the first fight, well, the fight, the rumble where
him and Biff,
him and Biff have their big, you know, go in toe to toe. There was something about the way that all set up and was choreographed that reminded me a lot of Beat It.
Oh, West Side Story for me.
But I mean, they're all very similar.
They're all played off that homage.
Yeah,
and West Side Story is really the first part.
Sure,
and Beat It came in, but I'm trying to. Beat It would have been right around the same time.
Right, and it was right about the same time.
83.
And the way it was, the way they came in, I mean, that was one of my favorite, I have a couple of favorite scenes, but that was one of my favorites because it was so theatrical.
Yeah.
The way they trained him in, the use of the light as thunder, and it kind of drove the action, and the way Biff's gang came in on the stage, coming in while you saw the boys on the bottom, I loved it. It was just, I was...
You mentioned the word stage there. Yes, the whole thing was designed to be
looked like
a stage.
Yes, it was so well done.
Biff enters, he's on the raised part of the platform with his gang behind him, and they're coming in at the orchestra pit.
And you have all these boys that are playing roles, mm-hmm. you know? They're not being true to themselves. They're playing... You know,
being gangs,
1950s gangs guys, you know, and I loved that scene. It was awesome.
For a long time in the movie, I also wasn't exactly sure what time period we were in.
Yeah, because
they do it on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and then there's one scene where it's like, oh, we're in the 80s.
Yep. Pac-Man.
Yeah, they're playing video games. Mm-hmm. Well, it was Pac-Man sounds, but he was obviously playing a racing game.
Yeah.
If you watch how
he was... Well, no, I know, but you hear
the... But it was the throttle control.
Which is what did it for me. So
it was like, whoa, what... What, where's this video?
Apparently, the motorcycle is a 1980s motorcycle.
Well, yeah, it's a cafe
and
racer.
I wouldn't have known that.
But he does that on purpose.
And I like that.
Oh,
because,
absolutely.
And you know what? Early 80s, that wasn't an uncommon look. It wasn't that. And what really threw me off was I was thinking, oh, this is like late 50s-ish, maybe.
Yeah, because you look at the cars, the and TVs, then, and the furniture. No, and no, whatnot.
Diane Lane's hair. That's what, that was like, no, this is 80s. No, the first time she's on, and she's got that big hair, and I was like, no, 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 no. You're not messing with me. This is the 80s. Yeah. And then it solidified with the video game, and it was like, all right, I know when I'm at now.
Well, but I think that's part of it too, though, is you've got, you know, the 50s kind of gang kind of movies, and in the 80s, it was really starting to emerge from now's kind of classic Bloods and Crips. And mm-hmm.
Well, because he does mention a couple of times that, you know, the drugs ruined everything.
Yes, well, heroin.
Yeah, the heroin ruined everything, and when the gangs come back, as if they existed before in this kind of golden age.
You know, and I also like that juxtaposition too, because you also have Rusty James admiring the past, this golden age of brotherhood that isn't reality.
Yeah, he's created this mythology, or
it is. It's all fiction.
Built it up to something.
Well, if you look at their age differences, he's 21, and Rusty James, what, about what, 16, 17 or so?
Probably.
So about the time that Motorcycle Boy was hitting his stride in the gang world, he had to be about 10 or 12.
Yeah, well, he mentions that in there, because Smokey disses him. Yeah. He says, well, you were about to, what, 10?
You were only 10? He said, no, I was 11.
Yeah. so you're right.
Yeah, I mean, so exactly. He's got this rather idealized vision of his brother and what he did, and he's grown up with this myth.
Well, and that was something I thought was unique too, and I'm not sure, I haven't read the story either, and I probably should have done that, but the use of mythology in general in this, because they reference Cassandra, mm-hmm. and this whole idea of you know, this Greek mythical beautiful woman who has the ability to foresee the future, but nobody believes her. I mean, and that's the curse that Apollo places on her. And so you have that piece. You have kind of the Robin Hood, Pied Piper theme in there. But I haven't, like, thought it enough through to kind of see, you know, does it carry over in other areas?
Well, that's kind of, again, one of the sore points that Rusty keeps bringing up, is that everybody talks over his head all the time, and he can't make the connections to what all this means. And that keeps kind of the tension going between him and his brother and his father, because they're always kind of talking around him, and he's always sitting on the outside of this trying to figure out what's going on.
Translate it. Well, and that was even the character of Midget Lawrence Fishburne's mm-hmm. character. You know, I'm kind of looking at it. One, why is this black guy in here? He looks a lot older than the rest of those boys.
And he's the, like, the one black guy?
That's an actual character, yeah.
Yeah.
But is he in a lot of green?
Well, until they go...
To the carnival, yeah. In whatever neighborhood that was at the Blues Bar. But is his role, and again, I haven't read the book, so I don't know how Midget fits in, but did Coppola use him as... Because it was a device that the Greeks used to they'd have this character whose sole purpose was to further the plot.
Right.
So he comes up, say, "Oh, Biff wants to, you know, rumble."
It's time
you.
To move things along.
And then that one scene where Rusty James is walking down the street, and all of a sudden Midget shows up and starts, "Hey, where's Motorcycle Boy?"
Right.
Well, then okay, then we're going to go off to this way. So that was another reference to mythology in Greek theater that I thought was kind of an interesting addition.
Yeah.
You know, that was, I mean, because I couldn't figure out why him, and two, how does he fit into this structure?
Right. Well, and that was one of the things that threw me off. And I think when I really had to stop and kind of reevaluate everything was the scene in the alleyway where him and Steve get accosted beat up by the two guys. And he gets bashed over the head and has, like, this out-of-body thing.
That's my favorite scene.
When he floats up out of this, and I'm like, what the hell am I watching? I'm seriously, I'm like, this is not The Outsiders anymore. I don't understand.
Yeah, well, I think the whole thing was to symbolize he was trapped between life and death.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, but it... It
I
was
it
so.
Some new technique that Coppola wanted to play with.
I was like, "This is
like, figure out
this is such a bizarre
well
departure."
So
Well, that edit, it doesn't fit with anything else that happens in the movie. It's this out of place scene that it's interesting because the device, the storytelling device, he's getting Rusty James to evaluate his relationships.
Right, step back
to
and take
step
a look.
Back and say, look, you know, oh, I'm screwing over
Patty.
Patty, thank you. Diane Lane's character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she really does have feelings for me. And, you know, these guys that I'm with that I'm supposedly friends with, that's not really anything going on.
Yeah,
and I'm leaving my life, but I don't really want to go. But even though I, you know, I seem to say to everyone, everything around me that, you know, I'm done with all of this. I kind of get what he was going for. It was just a really odd departure and just didn't fit with the rest of the movie. But I think that scene was the one that kind of drew me into the movie and said, okay,
oh, that's interesting.
This is the one, this is where I stopped thinking about the linear story because it's not really about what I thought it was about. It's something different and I need to stop paying attention to everything that's being said and specifically what they're showing me, but kind of what's the bigger story they're trying to tell. And because it wasn't, it's not as literal as everything we're seeing. And that one scene kind of made me start rethinking everything. And that's the point when I said, okay, I've got to stop looking at this just the way I would watch, you know, primetime television. It's not. Yeah. Or The Outsiders. Yeah. This, I have to stop looking for a literal, you're not feeding me anything. I need to look for the answers now. And that's where I really,
well, that's kind of one of the
subplots
of the subplots of the movie.
Yeah.
You have to look for your own answers.
Right.
I mean, that was the driving force of why Motorcycle Boy left. He wanted to look for some answers and Rusty iterates this thing several times. Says, "If I could just get out of here, you know, things would change for me." But he doesn't want. He wants to leave, and yet he can't. He doesn't want to leave. He's so attached to he's so clingy to his mythology that he just won't let go and go see the outside world.
You know what's it?
Well, I think it's fear too.
It is. He just doesn't. He really doesn't want to face the unknown
or be alone. I mean, he really
needs a lot of support. He's a very clingy character. He's a very clingy person.
Yeah.
Although, he needs his friends. He needs his brother. He needs his myth.
I think he needs to form a relationship. I mean, there was another line that the dad character in this, which is just so awesome for me, where he tells him, and again, it's that bar scene that I love.
Oh, that bar scene's great.
Where he tells him, "You didn't lose your mother. I lost your mother."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like a slap. You were too young. You didn't really know her. So how could you possibly really be pining away for her? Yeah, that scene, I love the way it was shot. I love the, was a kind of a transition point where you started kind of seeing more of an emotional connection between those. And you know, you can even push it to kind of look at it in terms of a triad, you know, with Motorcycle Boy at the right hand of the father and Rusty switching sides. I mean, he kept moving.
Yes.
You know?
He jumps from his brother's side to his father's side.
Yeah. Because he's trying to connect with the dad at one point because mm-hmm. he desperately wants the relationship, the connection that the brother has, but realizes, you know, because he doesn't understand his dad at all, and then goes to tries it, but I want to be just like you, and moves over to the other side of the table. But there's also a lot more. That's one of the first times you really get to see him initiate contact with Motorcycle Boy. Mm-hmm. And the father try to touch Rusty James. There's this where Rusty James goes and sits on that side, telling Motorcycle Boy, he's got his arm on, and his arm is on Motorcycle Boy's shoulder. Motorcycle Boy is holding his hand, Rusty James's hand, and then you see the dad, and the dad is like, "Oh, you poor boy," when Rusty James, "I just want to be just like, oh, you poor boy," and then goes to get up from the table, and I love the scene where he comes back looks at the boys, does the shot, takes the chaser, and then leaves. You know, it just it's just really well done. Very complex, yet really kind of cool.
Yeah, there was also another interesting little fact is when they both walk into the bar, he's sitting there with his Boilermaker, and as soon as he scoots over, he grabs his drinks and pulls them over to him.
And did you see him kind of go, like, oh, shit?
Yeah.
You
know, let me get my drinks here.
All right, then I got to turn on the smile because these are my kids, so I'm supposed to like them.
Yeah, he's sitting there all kind of folded up in himself and, you know.
Escaping.
I think he's already escaped.
No, totally not.
Fall into a hole.
So one of the things I was just thinking about, and again, this is probably a product of not having read the book, with how much mythology plays into it, I wonder if there's even more references that aren't as obvious than what they're stating. I wonder if Motorcycle Boy isn't possibly like an Odysseus reference. He's left, and he's done whatever, and kind of just left everyone to fend for themselves, and now that he's coming back, everybody's kind of looking to him to fix everything.
Set things straight.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been here without you, and Rusty James is getting to a point where he's like, hey, somebody has to take over. He is the de facto suitors.
Yeah, they're her parent.
He's horrible at it.
But he's and they were too.
Yep.
And just waiting for Odysseus to come back and fix things and get everybody set back on the right path. So I don't know if there's any reference there, but it just, I was kind of thinking about that and things were lining up. I don't know. I have to kind of think about that some more.
I'd have to mull that around a little bit and even map it out. Yeah, another one of my scenes that I really liked. There, I had two more, but was the pet store scene.
Mm-hmm.
They're going in.
Very creepy.
Well, but
there was a couple of pet store scenes. Which
the,
one?
The last one where
They're talking about the fish.
And it's one of the first scenes where you actually see Motorcycle Boy trying to teach his little brother.
Yeah.
Something, and that kind of interplay, but yet he's still kind of out there. His acute perception is kind of going off. And then you have the foreshadow with the cop. But it is creepy. But I like the way... The whole thing's kind of creepy. They did it all on purpose. But, like, the taxidermy animals...
Yeah.
You know, that are
in a
dead,
pet shop.
But they're dead, but meant to look real and alive. And it's so, again, it's a symbolic of the town. And, I mean, there's just so many neat things. The use of the mirror... to reflect in, and then you kind of go, then you have the reflection at the end, where it's the one of the only bursts of color where you actually have something human, where he sees his reflection mm-hmm. in color.
Yeah.
So you have all of these layers in that one scene. I just think it was really, really well done.
Yeah, and when Motorcycle Boy starts really pontificating on everything, we start seeing the movie coalesce. He sums it up, you know. If the fish are have to be kept apart with artificial barriers, otherwise they'll fight each other. And if you take away the artificial barriers and give them enough space, they'll go off and do their fishy things, or they'll go off and not fight.
Will they fight? And then the idea of the journey of discovery to the ocean
mm-hmm.
is another piece. But he failed at that, so that's kind of I'm kind of like mulling around the Odysseus idea because he actually failed at his.
Intended goal,
right?
The thing is, we never really find out what his journey was. We just know that he left and went to California, and he saw his mother. But did he see her in person, or did he see her in real life? And he never got to the ocean. Why? What distracted him?
Yeah.
He says, he says cryptically, California got in his way. Well, did he veer off and go sightseeing, or? Did he try to find his mother, or what? He just
or did he find his mother, and that's what the
distraction was?
That was the distraction.
I was the impression that he did find her.
Yeah, that's what I got too.
A lot about her. I mean, he saw her on TV prior to going.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the impetus for him going. Or did he come to the realization that he wasn't strong enough to really be free? I mean, he knew he was going to die.
He went into the unknown, and then he found it was just bigger than he was and had to come back and find stability.
Yeah.
But you can't go back home again.
He knew he was going to die. The scene in the pet store was also the only time he actually interacted verbally with the cop.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, Rusty did it. I mean, it was a great shot with the clock behind him and stuff, but it was, so it was the first time. So you kind of knew that this was not going to end well for him. And you, I mean, at least for me, I knew he knew that. And
yeah.
That's why he initiated that confrontation with the cop in the pet store. I think it was purposeful in order to force Rusty to be free.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, his last instruction was, take my bike and just go.
Yeah.
Go to the ocean.
Because that was...
That was one of the emphases, because Rusty says, I never had a reason to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you got a reason.
Yep.
Yep.
Move. I'm dead. I'm gone.
Well, and Motorcycle Boy knew he would do whatever he told him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I did,
at least on this thing.
Yeah. I did think of Adam when the first time you see the cop after he shoots Motorcycle Boy, he holsters his gun and immediately pulls out a cigarette.
Yeah.
Just relieved,
Yeah.
He just reached climax.
Right.
The thing he was working himself up to be, and so then he takes out the smoke.
He's done.
So I knew,
spent.
Yes. So Adam, if you're listening to this, that one's for you.
Oh, he won't listen to this. Let's not kid ourselves.
That's the main big sexual symbolism.
Yes, he just tricks his weapon.
Exactly.
Yeah, other than the...
You can really go over the top with it.
That orgy-like scene... At
the cabin,
At the cabin.
Mm-hmm. Smokey sets up.
Yeah, which... It's interesting how Rusty James doesn't really even consider that... Like, it's no big deal that happens. And when he goes back to Patty, she's like, hey... I had friends there. What the hell are you thinking?
But he doesn't know how to form any kind of human connection to anybody.
No.
And that was, when I was thinking about it, and kind of like, so he sees his reflection, so now he's really starting to kind of see the world the way he's supposed to, but the end of the movie is in black and white. He reaches the beach, and it's in silhouette.
Yeah.
So are you left kind of going, well, is he really free now? Is he, out of this adult purpose?
Well, it's more like he's taken the first step.
Yeah.
And he's actually accomplished something.
So we have hope.
He's accomplished the first goal.
Part of that could come from the fact that the ending is different than the ending of the book. And that was one thing that I learned was, apparently in the book, after Motorcycle Boy dies, he gets arrested.
Yeah.
And the ending... at the beach takes place 5 years later. So there's this considerable time jump, and it's actually, I think it's when Steve comes out to meet him, and
Matt,
it's like,
college.
Wow. It's just such a big jump.
Well, and they didn't really play that up at all, and so I need to go back to the book. The fact that Steve is kind of the transcriber.
The chronicler of the story here.
Yeah.
He's always writing down. I kind of wonder what he's writing down. Is he keeping a journal of a diary of what's going on, or he's just writing down his own feelings?
And he's kind of the adult voice in a lot of situations too, where he'll ask a question or challenge Rusty a little bit. So I'm kind of curious. In the book, do they elaborate more on what is he writing and how does that feel?
Well, the one thing is, there's an interesting establishing shot in the first part of the movie is. Steve is sitting behind Rusty, and the camera is looking at him over his shoulder. Yeah. Like, he's talking to Rusty as is he's the conscience.
Yes, yes. Oh, well, the whole debate in terms of even with Smokey is you had Steve behind him and then Rusty kind of playing on whether or not to go to the fight in that scene.
Right. Yeah. Steve is acting as the voice of reason,
yes.
Telling him, this is not a good idea.
Yeah.
And he's the voice of emotion saying, I want to do this.
We aren't supposed to do this. Motorcycle Boy, created this truce, and we're not supposed to do this.
Right, the voice of reason can argue with the voice of emotion.
Well, and he's always dressed in white.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too? Which was interesting. And the fact that I noticed Smokey also has one of the classic 50s kind of gang jackets. Or yeah. Nobody else does.
Right.
I mean, so even like their clothing was interesting.
The Wild Deuces.
Yes. And even in Chris Penn's character with, the, you know, you can tell he's kind of like the enforcer with the gloves. And
he's the big guy. He's, yeah.
He was, yeah, I actually liked his, I mean, it was a small role.
Right.
He was really good, too. I mean, it really was, it was a phenomenal cast.
A bunch of really great young talent. It's one of those movies where you look at it and say, man, somebody had some really great foresight. The casting director had really great foresight to find these young actors who many of them are still working and doing very well for themselves.
Yeah, and one of the things we haven't talked about is actually the imagery and the idea of just time passing. And
right, time flow seems to be a very big part of this, and it's always emphasized by moving clouds and lengthening shadows.
And the clocks.
And the clocks
everywhere.
And even like the ticking of the advertisement in Betty's Billiards was the click of the clock.
Well, yeah, the license, the sign turning over constantly.
Yeah. And that was something that I thought was a highlight for me. Just visually stunning.
Lots of smoke and fogs, and even when they shouldn't be there. I mean,
well, but that was, I mean, but that was again, it kind of was, you know, it was some of that.
Well, yeah,
it's like this Greek tragedy kind of.
Yeah, the really weird one was when Patty, Rusty and Patty are having their argument on the breakup. She's walking into the fog. And he's, you know, and she's slowly disappearing from his life.
But those are fires. Did you notice that?
No.
Those were controlled fires. Because in the background, you can see that some of them were in black and some of them white. So as it's getting heated, they're walking into, essentially, she's walking into the flames. It was
I took it as she was walking into a cloud and essentially fading from his life.
Yeah. But those are all controlled fires along the side of the road, which you're kind of going...
What was the smoke doing here?
But yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, so Jeff just popped into the chat room and asked where Adam is when we're covering a Nick Cage movie. I don't think I mentioned this on the recording, but I was telling Jill earlier that I actually told Adam that we're doing this movie and Nick Cage is in it. And he's like, oh, hands down, best movie of the year. without any further commentary.
But but those themes, those visual themes, I thought were really kind of cool. And the clouds, the clocks, but also there was a lot of ideas of freedom, the idea of carnival, the fact that they left to get out of town, they go to a carnival.
They ride the motorcycle.
That's the phenomenal transition.
Oh yeah.
You know, and that interplay between the two boys and that childlike. Reaction that Rusty has to running the red light, to hitting the bump, and it was. I love the way that scene was filmed in terms of that
bond
between
the impression
boys.
That Rusty had never ridden on the
He'd
motorcycle
never been with his brother.
In that way.
Yeah,
and you know, he's a little hesitant at first, but once he's into it, you notice him laying his head on his shoulder, like, you know, this is great. Why, you know, haven't I done this before? Why didn't we do this?
It's intimate.
Yeah.
It's one of the first truly intimate moments you see with him. I mean, he falls asleep on Patty.
Yeah.
You know, the one scene is with some girl, you know, and that's, you know, he doesn't even know her names and it means nothing to him. But that scene was one of the few times you actually see him intimate. I mean, because he does. He buries his head.
One of the things that Coppola and Hinton did really cool with this and The Outsiders is they showed male love and the bonds that a brother can have that you don't see that intimacy a lot in movies. You really don't. I mean, you see, you know, guys bonding in sports or things like that, but that kind of touching intimacy,
sibling love,
you just don't see that that much.
And
they showed it
gestures.
So beautifully, you know? in both movies.
Yeah. Well, and Coppola talks about that a little bit in terms of why he wanted to do this film was because of the hero worship and the connection between his brother, August. And so that was one of the themes that he really wanted to explore. But that scene was...
The movie was awesome. Dedicated to his brother. Mm-hmm. I noticed when I looked through the credits, I noticed that that it was dedicated to him.
Well, did either one of you guys notice? I had to go look it up because I was just curious because I recognized the actor, but the movie that's on the TV
The Bela Lugosi movie,
yes, which is called Murder by Television. Any idea why? Like, why Bela Lugosi?
No.
That was a conscious choice. It had to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody knows who he is. So, I don't know the movie, but I was kind of like, so I wanted to throw that out. That question out there is, what did you guys think when you saw it? Or is it one of those things where it just, there was so much in it?
Well, I think it's kind of a homage back to the creature features on Friday night. You don't see this hardly anything anymore, but back in the 70s,
in the 80s,
you had the Friday night creature feature, and you'd have the usually a potboiler film of some sort from the 30s, 40s, or 50s. Mm-hmm. And that's what me and my girlfriend like to watch monster movies together so they could cuddle up on the couch and that sort of thing.
Because we didn't have VCRs to go rent those movies.
Yeah.
So
right, and also the in between sections of the movie, they'd have the rather schlocky
Elvira.
You had the Elvira. You had other ones in there too, Seymour or something like that. Who would Crypt Keeper would come in and make they had these little skits that were kind of corny and whatnot. And sometimes they were more interesting than the movie in itself.
Yeah.
But that's essentially what you're seeing there is the Friday night horror.
So you think it's just to kind of set up...
It's a little homage, to set the time period and give him a reason to be there.
Maybe. I mean, and there may have been more to it. There may have been some commentary. If there is, it was lost on me.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the scene again, but I didn't, when I first, other than recognize it was Bela Lugosi, it was like, oh.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, it wasn't Dracula. Which I could have seen play out a little bit.
Yeah.
In terms of, again, adding to that whole concept of being trapped or freedom. And
so I've got a question, Daryl. You said early on when we started the conversation that you liked the movie, but there were parts of it that you didn't like as much.
Well, there's the parts that I really didn't go for is the rather convoluted plot. I mean, you have to sit there and really pay attention to this movie to get everything out of it. And, well, I know.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, it's you have to follow along very carefully as to what's going on all the time. And there was one scene which I didn't particularly care for much. I think it was the pet shop scene. Just the tension in there is really just a little too weird.
Not the first one where they're laying out the where he's talking about the fish, or the second one where he broke in and he's freeing all the animals.
No, which when he's talking about the fish, I know what they were trying to do in there and whatnot. Just something in me just didn't particularly go for that. I mean, it just seemed like an awful convoluted way to say, we're trapped in fish balls, and if we could just get out and whatnot. I mean, it's technically beautiful. It's a beautiful setup.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's probably obviously from the title of the movie, it's a critical to have that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine, without having read the book, that scene is probably what they looked at first when Coppola's like, we need to make this movie. I mean, everything kind of hinges on that scene. And if you don't have someone like Mickey Rourke playing the character he's playing, that scene doesn't work
right.
at all.
He's the only person
not necessarily the only person who can do it, but the way he acts through this movie, where he's just kind of disconnected and present but not really there.
Well,
where
he's kind of distracted. His stream of conscious monologue there it just doesn't work for me. I just don't know why, but it just doesn't.
And see, for me, I think that's really the hallmark of that character. Sure. And where a lot of people think, and they comment on it, that he's insane, you know?
Well, that's the first time we actually, he is sharing with Rusty James this concept of acute perception.
Right.
It's the first time Rusty is allowed to hear what is going on in his head. And it is very, it's not straightforward. It's very symbolic, but that's the point.
Right.
That's why people don't get Motorcycle Boy, is because it's far more abstract and he thinks deeper about things as dumb as little fish.
Right. And it's what's great about the way the story is structured is that we have that sequence in the carnival before that where he's kind of wandering through and he looks like he's stoned. He's just wandering through.
I thought he was on an acid trip, tell you the truth.
And he's happy and he's just kind of wandering through and just kind of soaking it all in. And he almost looks like he's high.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where everybody else thinks he's either, probably they think he's crazy or he's stoned. He's just, this is just the
really
way.
Really deep. I mean, the guy that talks about how deep he is.
Right. And or it's just the fact that he is perceiving everything differently. Because they're even asking him, so how does he see this? You know, does he sees it all in black and white. How they're trying to suss out what he is perceiving as they're just kind of following him through.
Well, that's a neat little psychological thought there, is how do I perceive somebody, what somebody else is seeing?
Right.
And when I have no basis of reference there. If I never saw color, how could I ever describe it to you?
Right. And then when he goes in to talk about the fish, it really speaks back to what he's explaining to you, kind of like what the baseline is for. Here, look, this is how I perceive the world.
Well, that's one
so
thing.
So I'm explaining to you what conceptually I was drawing in. Now, I'm not going to explain to you literally what all my perceptions were as I was doing that, but by kind of using this as the baseline, you can go figure out for yourself why I was doing what I was doing and what I might have been perceiving.
Well, that's one thing as is that our choice in a movie here about why they use black and white. Is once you strip away all the color, you strip away all the distractions, and you just see the contrasts.
And they went for high contrast.
And very high contrast. We're really sharpening things up in this whole movie.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the kind of little subplots there is, you know, once you remove the distractions, you start seeing everything as it really is. Black or white, good or bad.
Red or blue. For the fish.
Mm-hmm. Red or blue for the fish, yes.
I don't think it's as simple as black or white. I mean,
no.
I think that
well, that's it's just sort of, just use that as a kind of a hook there. It's separate away all the distractions. I mean, if we had filmed this, if he had done this thing in Technicolor, would it have been as interesting? Would all these little technical effects been as useful?
No, but I think that's why he chose it too. Mm-hmm. Was also because he could get the images he wanted to kind of show that when you strip your life down for an anguished teenager, it is about being trapped and being conflicted, being dulled.
Mm-hmm.
That's more rather than and it might be how I interpret black and white. When I think of black and white, I think right or wrong. And that this is gray. This isn't about black and white. This is about just everything being muddled, and the only person
confusing.
Really can well, yeah, absolutely, because that's Rusty. But the only person who really gets it is the person with the acute perception, is Motorcycle Boy, but yet he can't be free until other than death is his way out.
Right.
And also how he frees his brother.
Mm.
Yeah, by killing my myth.
You know, because it kind of goes into, the conscious choice of black and white has to do with also what I think what he's trying to do in terms of references to existentialism, references to a lot of the art films coming out of the late 50s, early 60s, you know, kind of Truffaut. So I really think he was trying to kind of go, yeah, I've been stuck doing doing this Hollywood movie. Now I kind of want to do it differently. And he talked about it as an art film. Mm-hmm. And so when the critics start talking about the poor dialogue and things, I'm like, well, you don't get it. It's not necessarily supposed to. You're supposed to. It's a movie.
You watch it.
Well, but you're also, viewer is supposed to inject something into it themselves and be forced to kind of sit and kind of let it rumble around in your head until you figure it out, your meaning of it.
Right. Like, when I started watching this movie, when I got, like I said, about an hour into it, I kind of baselined on the thought, this is a music video for Stuart Copeland. this is just Fritz Ford Coppola doing a double Dutch rudder on Stuart Copeland, and you know, they're all just making art.
Yes.
And you know, this is fine and this is wonderful and we're not going to have much to talk about because I don't really get what's going on. It's not that interesting. And then things, like I said, things just started piecing together that it was more an art house movie. But again, I came in with the notion that this is going to be something more straightforward and mainstream. So I was, my expectation for it was way off. And so the things I was expecting to see, I wasn't seeing, and I was getting so much more and so different that I think I kind of felt like I was at a disadvantage for not understanding that from the beginning, because I wasn't looking for certain things. I wasn't reading more into it and watching more for the background imagery and looking for, you know, looking for a few of those things. I think, you know, as far as that goes, I think if you know going into the movie that it's not mainstream, it's not straightforward, it's not The Outsiders, it's something a little more esoteric and art house, you'll get so much more out of it. Mm. Just because your expectations will be there and you'll be looking for it earlier.
Well, and you won't get distracted. Too.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to see it again. I mean, I've only seen it once. I only saw it last night. But I think really, it's for me, I was at a disadvantage because I kind of had to play catch up, where I was, you know, two-thirds of the way through the movie before I kind of got it. And so then I'm having to replay it all in my head as I'm rushing toward the end, because at this point I'm getting pretty close to, I mean, it, you know, all of a sudden now I'm in the pet shop and they're having this conversation. It was like that, because that's about where I was at when this all kind of crashed on me, and I was like, man, this is getting really good. And I really kind of got it. And then after the fact is when I looked at IMDb and Wikipedia and saw the critical reaction, and it was, you know, I could understand how
it
got booed. I can understand how critics panned it. I can understand that, because what the expectation of what Coppola had done before and what he was doing now, I get why people were upset and they didn't like this movie.
Well, you know, as a director, that can be kind of refreshing, because rather than getting all these accolades that may be real or phony, now they're giving me their real opinion of what my work is about. I'm getting actual reviews. Maybe they're not happy with it, but at least I'm getting some critical opinion.
And honestly,
they're not a bunch.
Yeah,
I mean, and therefore anything a critic says is meaningless.
Right.
I mean,
it doesn't mean anything.
I think they all kind of figure that out anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, I mean, he didn't do this movie for money. He didn't do this money,
He did this movie because he wanted to do it.
I love when artists do something because they have a vision, not because they're getting paid to do it. Mm-hmm. And
but I think the big difference between this and Red State is the level of
craftsmanship and artistry.
But that's also one of Coppola's gifts. He sees things very, very differently. And he has the background, and this is something that Kevin Smith does not have.
Yeah.
His visual background is different. It's comic books, and that works for him. Tarantino has a similar background, not classical, but in terms of going and studying the true master films.
Yeah.
And you can see that in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's one of the things I'd like to go back and be able to go through each piece, because when I watch it, I see conscious decisions in terms of blocking. I see conscious decisions and references to pieces in the past. I mean, that was one of the things I loved about the fight scene in the beginning. It reminded me of things like West Side Story, of those classics.
And it was very,
so
it was,
you got it.
It was, the fight was elegant.
Yeah.
It was so cool when he jumped up and grabbed the bar and pulled it down and steam started flying out. And, you know, it was just so fluid, and it was like they danced this dance before. And it was so nice.
You know,
it
and
really
that's
was.
The same thing.
And
with,
Rusty's in his element. He's actually he's actually happy.
He's
alive.
Having a great time. He's having a great time with it. He is.
Yeah, I'm living the dream.
You know, but and that's the scene. You know, the way that the scene with the two boys and their dad in the bar. That was a classically shot scene with the foreground being set up to draw your eye to the father, because the father is really the connection between these two boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of those things, when you start having those references, they have meaning in and of themselves. And if you don't have that vocabulary, and that's the thing that Kevin Smith has to develop,
yeah,
if he wants to kind of stretch the boundaries beyond the comic book style, you have to study it. I mean,
I think this movie, I can understand how this movie could play better today than it did at the time, because from my perception, movies that are a little more art house is more mainstream than it used to be.
Well, it's more accessible.
Accessible is the word I was looking for. People understand the language of art house a whole lot better than they may have in 83 when this came out, especially if they're looking at the point of, you know, what has Coppola done before this? And now this is what we're getting.
Yeah.
You know, this is beyond anything we expected.
Yeah, but when you look now 30 years ahead, we don't have to worry about all his past stuff. We can look at this movie independently.
Well, and there are elements that in terms of visual elements that he did do in Apocalypse Now that he carries over now they're in black and white, but
right.
There he has a particular style in terms of how he structures particularly more intimate setups that you can see in The Godfather. In Apocalypse Now, I saw more of a connection because of movement that Godfather just didn't have. That he does use in Rumblefish. But, I mean, because he does have a language
mm-hmm.
that he's developing. That's what he was saying.
Well, I'm going to take just a brief diversion here. We talk about black and white films as now being an artistic style. But the style developed from the 1930s and 40s because of a technical limitation of the film at the time. There was no color. So the DPs of that time had to learn to work with this medium and get the most out of it. And they were really good at doing it in terms of the lighting, the camera angles, the choice of lenses and whatnot to bring out all the features or all the capabilities of the film. Now we've taken this style and now we call it an art with a capital A instead of a little a. And we use this as a big hammer to say, well, I'm going to do black and white because I want art.
Well,
I
think we should save this discussion until we watch
mm-hmm.
all the movies, because I think at this point I'm leaning more to the side of artistic choice and
mm-hmm.
why was this particular film in black and white? Did it service the story they were telling? Was it a limitation of budget? Was it a limitation of technical prowess? Or was it a conscious choice based on the storytelling? Did it service the story?
Well, technical prowess, black and white is harder to do now because a lot of those techniques that were very common back then had to be rediscovered now. And not everybody is capable of pulling it off.
But a movie like Clerks, the reason it was in black and white was purely 16 millimeter.
Yeah, it was 16 millimeter really film stock.
And that's the idea of picking modern black and white movies is why and does it work?
Right.
And in this movie,
it was a stylistic choice.
Exactly. And you could not pull off the visual imagery of the passing of time and the kind of urgency that the clouds and the shadows that it brought to the table, and to do it in color,
yeah.
I just don't think you would have gotten that sensation.
The moving,
it would have been just moving clouds, another story.
Yeah.
The moving clouds would have looked goofy. The smoke in the scene where they're breaking up would have looked it would have looked more like flames and fires. It wouldn't have served to be that feeling of loss of her fading off, and quite frankly, the fish in the
wouldn't have been as starkly pulled
it would
out.
It made you focus on what they were talking about and really draw you in to the conversation through the fish because they stood out so starkly.
Well, and because of that contrast, though, is you also got this. I mean, that was the whole message in my mind, was that they don't have any freedom. They don't see color because they don't have. They're not free to be who they are. They don't know who they are. They've lost that kind of innocence that you have as a little kid when you can be anything you want to be. And to do it in color, you would have had to talk it all, and it just wouldn't have been.
I think it would have just been another little melodrama. That would have had been sustained on weak dialogue.
I think it also kind of plays into what you were saying earlier, how you thought that where Rusty James was the main character, the protagonist, it was really kind of narrated or told through the lens of Motorcycle Boy, being that he has this acute perception and colorblindness. Showing it in black and white, which is not really how colorblindness works, but to show it how colorblindness works would have been...
It would have been very strange.
It would have been extreme.
But he even talks about how he sees the world as like a black and white TV.
Right.
With the sound turned down. And so I think that it does play into how this guy views the world. And the whole story is about him trying to explain to his little brother how he sees the world.
Right.
But couldn't until he has the vehicle of the fish. But we are lucky enough to see it from the get-go, which is unnerving and kind of like, all right, this is weird. I don't get this. Why? But that's the point.
Right, right. Yeah, I missed the part where he said it was like the volume was turned down. That now makes me think that could be another part of why he spoke so softly, because that was the volume he heard everyone else at. So he was matching that volume, kind of like when we have our ears muffled, we talk louder because we're trying to match
how loud it is
in our head, because that must be how loud you need to hear me speak at.
So one of the sub themes here is perceptions.
Oh yeah, and so Jeff typed a little bit for us. He said, and this was from about 15, 20 minutes ago, I think, from an existential perspective, the individual suffers from the inability to perceive the world the same as others. Motorcycle Boy cannot perceive the world in color, and he longs for the moments when he has those brief connections with others. Each person is imprisoned in a world of their own perceptions, in a world of their own perceptions, and unable to see themselves as others see them, e.g. in the mirror. So
when the mirror, the fish doesn't recognize it's him, it's itself. So that's why it attacks.
Right. And it kind of speaks to the self-destructive nature that Motorcycle Boy has in the end. He's pretty much saying
Rusty James throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
He doesn't recognize himself in his own actions.
No. No, and then when he does, when he does see himself, he thinks, all I have to do is go back to these people and they're going to accept who I perceive myself as. And when he goes back to Patty and she's with Smokey, and he's like, yeah, Smokey's like, what are you doing here? You know, you've screwed this up enough. Go away.
Well, that's the other thing.
Well, let's go outside. I'm not going to fight you. You know, that's not what this is about anymore. And she's like, no, let's just go outside and talk.
Well, that's the one thing when Smokey really shoots him down is when he tries to attempt to hand over his mantle of authority. And he says, don't flatter yourself. You never had anything to start with.
And see, and that's really interesting. Looking back at it, Rusty James sees himself as the leader. But and from the way the story's told, it appears that he is. Until you really look at like that sequence when they're all waiting, supposedly waiting for him when he's with Patty. They're just waiting. They're just waiting for the right time.
And he knows he's not, and that's why he anesthetized himself. That's why he drinks. That's why, I mean, he knows in his own, you know, inside his own
heart. Very insecure, let's put it this way.
I mean, he knows he's not the leader. He knows he's not Motorcycle Boy.
No matter how hard he tries, he can never be him.
You know?
I think part of him believes that he is the leader, though.
Well, yeah, he has the fantasy
because Motorcycle Boy was, and he's the heir.
He wants to be Motorcycle Boy.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and but yet he knows he can't be, and he thinks it's because he doesn't really understand who Motorcycle Boy, and desperately wants that connection, but it's not possible.
Yeah.
Until the end, I mean, he does because of Motorcycle Boy making him promise. He forces him to figure out who he is leading.
He hands over Motorcycle Boy literally gives Rusty James his identity. Take the motorcycle.
Escape bullet and
become who I was by taking the motorcycle. By taking the only identity anyone has of me as is the Motorcycle Boy. Take the motorcycle.
Well, I don't know about that as much as take the only way to escape.
Well, it's also the only way to escape.
Because Motorcycle Boy is the poster child of the lost youth. I mean, that's the title. I mean, what is the future of our youth is the title of the article that he is the poster.
Oh, yeah.
So I think he knows his brother's kind of lost, and the only way to save his brother is to leave. And it's too late for him.
Yeah.
He's the myth. And the only way to end the myth is the death of the myth, and that's why we see Rusty in color in his reflection. It's the first time he sees himself without the myth.
Yeah.
But it's not fully developed, which is why it goes away, and it's now up to Rusty James to bring the color into his own life.
Yep.
I think that's it.
Yeah. I think that's the end.
And let's end on that note right there.
All right. So, again, next week, Following, and then blanking, what's the one we're going to do after that?
Do you want to do the Coen Brothers, the Man Who Wasn't There?
We're going to do Man Who Wasn't There, then Good Night and Good Luck.
And those will be some interesting comparisons in terms of...
Good Night and Good Luck is the only one of these, at this point, that is not on Netflix. So
check out iTunes.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually going to get it from my library. I know my library has it. It's expected. When I knew that movie and it was like, yeah, without even looking, I assumed the library system would have that one. All right. See you guys next time.
Thanks for coming.
A minute. All right, so we're done recording. We just remembered the most important thing that we should have talked about. Diane Lane was hot. Oh my God.
She was.
She still is, but
I'll take your word for that. I haven't seen her, so
yeah.
What has she done lately?
She was in Hollywoodland.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
And she was hot in Hollywoodland, but yeah, she was this. Trying to remember the time frame. This was before she did Streets of Fire. And she was hot in Streets of Fire.
I thought the image of her up on the bookcases under the clock as a metaphor for how adolescent boys pass time in school was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's just, she exudes this youthful sexuality that's like, you almost want to grab Rusty James by the throat and just shove him in her cleavage and say, would you look at what you're wasting?
Well, they do that, though.
Yeah.
The way she's dressed when she comes to meet Smokey.
Yeah.
As opposed to how she's dressed when she meets him. She's in basically a shirt and shorts, and she puts on makeup when he comes to her house. She knows he's coming.
Right.
But she doesn't dress for him there. She does with Smokey.
And because he appreciates
it. Totally different.
Yeah. It shows how she reacts to being appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Well, being treated as a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where Smokey seems kind of, because it's not a true perspective, I always kind of looked at Smokey as a little bit smarmy.
Oh yeah, I didn't like him.
He was a little bit of like an Eddie Haskell kind of character.
Totally.
But that's really the perception of other people. And so I almost want to see a perception, like a glimpse of reality. What is he really like? Is he really just kind of a nice guy? But because of how fractured Rusty James is, this guy just is a kiss ass.
Well, but it's also, I mean, that kind of fits in with the movie, though, mm-hmm. is the whole idea of, you know, perception in general.
Right.
In terms of what is
what's reality and what's perception. And I think that plays into it really well, because when Rusty James shows up to meet her and she's with Smokey, he doesn't even get it.
Nope.
He's like, this doesn't compute. It's just, he just can't understand what's happening in that moment. And it seems like at that point, that's when it finally dawns on him that she's hot.
Yeah.
It's like,
oh, what? I never seen you this way before when you're all tarted up like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold it, you're a woman?
Well, yeah, the cleavage with that dress.
Yep.
It was, totally different. At first, when she first walked in, I was like, wait a minute, is that Patty?
Yeah.
When did you become a woman?
And on the converse, Sophia Copeland? Mm-hmm. Or so Coppola?
Mm-hmm.
Still ugly. It's not nice to say about children, but
so not an ugly duckling face for her.
Just no, it was never a phase.
Well, for Diane Lane, her last three movies were Secretariat in 2010,
yes,
Cinema
yes.
Verte, and soon to be, her next appearance will be in The Man of Steel as Martha Kent.
That's right.
I forgot the Secretariat.
That's right.
But you will not be into, we'll not see her until 2013.
She's playing opposite of, I'm blanking, Costner
mm-hmm.
as Jonathan.
She was nominated for two awards in 2011 for Cinema Verte as Best Actor. Best
Knights in Rodanthe with Richard Gere. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jeff.
So you can still catch her.
All right. Now we're done.
All right.
For realsies.